Welcome. We have a presentation this morning on the Wildcat. Wildcat, as I heard him say, was really the only Navy airplane that was available when the war fighter that was available when the war started. It performed yeoman service. It could not compete with the Zero, but they learned how to do it so that they could compete with the Zero. And I'm not going to talk about that. All I want to do is on the owner of this beautiful airplane, who's brought it in here for all of us to enjoy, Mike Gillian. Well, by the way, I'm Bill Harrison. Not that that means anything. But.
So I'm privileged to fly this. It's a heck of a lot of fun. I hope you guys have a lot of questions because I'm not a real good public speaker. I got this about 4 years ago. I have a fair amount of T6 time and a lot of PITS time. That's what helped me learn how to fly it. Of course, with this thing, the first time you fly it is the first time you fly it. It's kind of tricky on the ground, but it's an absolute delight in the air. Real simple airplane. The landing gear cranks up and down, and the flaps are vacuum operated. The only hydraulics are the brakes. So it's simple for a guy like me. That's a good thing. As Bill said, the original Wildcat was kind of outclassed by the Zero. This is a development version. This is the FM2 that was built by GM. And it has a different engine than the first series. It has the Wright 1820-56, which is 1,350 horsepower. They went back to the four-gun configuration. They put a bigger tail on it to handle the extra power. And by all accounts, it was quite a lot more capable against the Zero by the time it came into service. And, of course, the quality of the Japanese pilots was very diminished by the time it was in service. So this one's painted in the markings of a observation squadron. Late in the war, they decided it'd be better to put the guys in something like this than have them running around in an L-19 or, some other small, slow airplane. This could defend itself, and the guys proved to be remarkably effective. The other big use for this was on the escort carriers, because it's so much smaller than the Hellcat or the Corsair, they could get a lot more of them on, and it proved to be very effective both in the Atlantic and the Pacific. The Wildcat was built throughout the whole war in one series or another, and all the Allies used it. You know, the Brits never did make a seaborne fighter that was worth a damn until they came up with the Sea Fury. So they liked it quite a lot, and I do too.
What did the Brits call it?
They called it the Martlet.
Yeah.
I think the first Japanese airplane shot down from an aircraft carrier was shot down by a Wildcat, and I can't remember the guy's name right now. He ended up being a very famous British test pilot. I'll bet you a bunch of you guys know his name. But he really liked the airplane, and it was far superior to anything they had. It's really a handful on the ground. I'm very cautious with crosswinds. My friend Mike Burke did a lot of coaching. I actually got a wingtip a couple years ago down at Sun and Fun. The drill is that you take off and land, at least I do, in a three-point configuration. And the first thing you do when you get it down on the ground is scrub off the flaps, and it kind of settles down on the gear. The tricky thing about this is that the oleos are really soft, and so the airplane will lean whichever way it chooses into the wind. And you can't do anything about it with the ailerons. They're too small. So you just have to discount the lean and keep it going straight. So you might be going down the runway like this, and it feels weird as hell, but as long as the airplane's going straight, you're in good shape. And, you know, the thing was designed to land in 35 feet on a boat, so it's not very happy on a hard surface. He asked if the wingfold system was manual or hydraulic. There's a crank in here that pulls a pin out, and then the guy, a taller guy standing on the wingtip, kind of walks it back, and then it's tied off to the tailplane. But it's strictly manual.
How many veterans do we have in the audience? Oh, that's great. Just interrupt just 1 minute to thank you all for your service and remind you that the medals, like the one I've got on, are available for the veterans over there at that little kiosk over next to the Orange Tower. And then tomorrow, Friday at 2:30, the veterans will march from here down to Show Center. So don't forget it. We'd love to have you. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Mike.
That's all right. Speaking of veterans, I ran into a veteran at the in Cincinnati who flew these in training. You know, towards the end of the war, a lot of these were used for training. Matter of fact, this one was built in 1944 and went to the West Coast, came back to Chicago. He trained on this airplane, and then they sent him out to a boat, and I can't remember if they had Hellcats or Corsairs there, but his first flight in a Hellcat or a Corsair was off the boat and back onto it. I mean, things were way different in those days.
They also had tail hooks to help them. You ask about the landing. If you're landing on the boat, the gear configuration doesn't make a whole lot of difference.
That's correct. It is kind of a handful on the ground, but it's really quite a lot more benign than a T-6 in the air. It does great acro at really low power settings, does great acro at high power settings, and stalls and spins very straightforward. I spin it almost every time I fly it. It's a lot of fun.
Deliberately?
Yes, sir. Most of the time.
Most of the time. Well, that's good.
What's the maximum load factor? You mean how many G's? I think it's 8 or 9. I never come close to that. I probably pull 4 in a loop. Never come close to what it's stressed for. And this is very light compared to what they were in the day. This weighs 5,300 pounds empty. With me in full fuel, it's just over 6,000. In the day, they were gross weight 7,500, and they went over that all the time. I don't have any armor or guns or any of that stuff, so it's really light. One of the other interesting things that I'm sure a bunch of you know is this airplane doesn't have a VNE. You can literally dive it straight at the ground with full power, and you know it's draggy enough that it never gets VNE. That's how they actually tested them. In the day, they take them up to 20,000 feet and dive them to 10. So, one of the weird things about it.
How many of you have heard the expression Grumman Ironworks? This is the airplane that gave it to them, the original model, the Grumman built one. It's just built stout. It could be shot at and just always survive.
Right. It's, you know, the advantage this had over the Zero was the self-sealing fuel tanks. And the armor that it had, you know, the Zero didn't have any of that, so it could take a pretty good licking.
How many were built?
I think there were, if I remember correctly, there's 5,000 that GM built of the FM2. It's kind of interesting. Grumman only built one. I think they called it the XF-8 or something like that. And then they gave it to GM, and within 8 months, those guys were building them faster than Grumman ever did. I don't know how many, I can't remember how many Wildcats were built during the war. My son could tell you, but he didn't make it.
See these airplanes take off to the carrier and porpoise to get the gear up. Do you have that problem, or do you porpoise it to get the gear up?
Well, I've never watched myself take off, but I don't think I do. It is kind of interesting because being relatively short and having short arms, I have to leave the harness, my shoulder harness, loose so that I can lean forward to get enough leverage to get the gear up. And you have to keep it below 100 knots or it gets really hard with the air load. And you don't ever, ever, ever let the handle go. You either get it all the way up or you get it all the way down. You know that. I mean, you've got the same thing in the duck. It can freewheel and go all the way down and break the chains and the gearbox and all of that, and then you've got a problem.
There's some rumors out there that somebody had their chains break lately.
Right.
I hope you've never had that problem. And what would cause that? Are you just wear on the chain? Are you trying to keep that greased all the time?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question. Greg Shelton's the guy who's broken the chains a couple of times now. And one of the interesting things we found out was that the chains actually came from Coney Island, you know, the plant was out that way, so they used chains that were used on the rides. And Greg flies a pretty aggressive routine. He pulls a lot of G's. And then I think that the chains have been replaced probably on his airplane a couple of times. I think mine are original. And there's no master link. It goes right into the whatchamacallit, you know, the slack adjuster or whatever you want to call it. It's just pinned in there. There's no master link, which I think is the weak point. And I can't, it's not a high stress deal, you know. It up and down isn't that hard, and the chains are pretty big. So I'm staying with the originals. We inspect the hell out of them, and it's self-lubricating. Well, you can see there's some of the fluid. So I don't worry about them too much, but we look at them real hard. And, you know, you can see them real clearly on the pre-flight.
Mike, how much fuel does it carry?
I carry 126 gallons, which is good for maybe 3 hours. At 2 hours, I'm really looking hard to find some place to get on the ground. In the day, they carry 200-gallon drop tanks, but if you think about the guys launching off the boat, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old with going out 200 miles and then having to find the boat, you know, gee whiz.
Does this one have a place for the catapult harness?
Yeah, there's a hook right under here, you know, that put a bridle on and shoot it off that way.
What were some of the tactics that World War II fighter pilots used against the Zero? Could this outdive a Zero?
I believe it could outdive it. The main thing they came up with was teamwork and the notion that they weren't going to turn with them. They weren't going to dogfight. It was going to be in and out. Because if they tried to turn with the Zero, they were toast. But they developed the thatch weave, which I'm sure most of you have read about. You know, what our guys did was take kind of a bad situation, make the best of it.
Yes, a question up here about what's your fuel consumption generally in cruise?
It's around between 45 and 50 gallons an hour, and that's at 29 inches and about 1,900 RPM. That yields usually around 200 knots of ground speed. And now if I'm pushing it up or flying an air show routine, it's quite a lot more. But generally, I figure 45 or 50 gallons an hour, which, you know, in the Warbird environment's pretty reasonable.
I've got a Pitts Spearman.
Yes, sir.
Does that help to prepare? I mean, how does that act a little bit different than a Pitts or a Stearman?
The Stearman I don't know very much about. I've only flown one once or twice. This Pitts I have a lot of time in. And the thing that this thing does that's just like a Pitts, you know how when you get it on the ground and you think everything's good, and then it leaves again? Right. That's this. So I think the Pitts time is really a big help in this airplane. I mean, you just have to keep it straight. So I scrub the flaps off right away, and I get hard on the brakes to get it down to walking speed just as fast as I can. The problem with that is that because I don't have a tail hook and the radios and the remote compass aren't in the back anymore, I've got 38 pounds of lead all the way aft, but even so, it's pretty tail light. So if you get on the brakes, you know, that's a bad thing.
Is your forward visibility pretty good? You know, on a 3-point in a Pitts,
it's gone. It's real good all the way down, and you can make a really steep approach, you know, which is really nice. But the minute you flare for landing, it's gone. And that's where you learn, you know, you don't look to the sides. You just right down the middle and try and keep everything the same.
How much do you have to reduce your power because of the low octane ratings?
Well, the airplanes, the 1820-56 was used in a lot of airplanes. It's still used in the T-28s. Higher marks, you know, they're 75s or 80, I don't even know. But they're rated for a lot more horsepower. And they up the manifold pressure that you can pull. The red line in this is 46.5 inches and 2,700 RPM. And I'm not too shy about going there. I usually pull someplace between 40 and 46.5 inches on takeoff. And if I'm screwing around or doing an air show, you know, I'll pull 40, 42, 43 inches. It doesn't seem to bother it. You know, my theory is that these engines were built to run, and I run it.
Do you know much about the history of this aircraft between World War II and nowadays?
What I know is that It got mustered out in 1946, and as far as I know, it disappeared for a while. I think I saw it when I was a kid at gas stations around Pewaukee Airport in Chicago, and I might get some verification of that later on. It was rebuilt by World Jet, I think, and or someplace in Colorado in 1989. And then a guy from England, a collector from England, bought it, took it over there and painted it. I met those guys here on Tuesday. And they had it for about 15 years, some of it in storage. It they only flew it 4.5 or 5 hours the whole time. Came back to the States. Sam Tabor put it together. It was sold to a guy in California who had it ferried out to Phoenix, where it sat in a museum for over a year. He never did anything with it. And then we bought it, and we've had it since, I think, 2007. When I started flying it, it had 47 hours on the 1989 restoration. Yeah. Sir.
Sorry to keep asking you questions.
No, it's good.
The brakes, I've heard, are kind of a, you've got maybe one or two applications like the DC-3 I fly.
Right.
Is that kind of the same way?
Well, if you probably can't see, but I've got red line brakes on it.
I thought so.
Okay. I never had to fly it with the originals, which I guess are just god-awful. They're Dodge truck brakes or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first thing that happens when you start it is they get lubricated real good. And so they're even worse. But the red lines are great. This airplane in any kind of big wind is a pain in the, you know what, to taxi because it's either a locked or a free swiveling tailwheel. And you have to use brakes. It's the only way to taxi. So the red lines are a great investment. T6 or this is just fantastic.
How many hours is your engine good for, do you think?
It's a good, great question. The 1820-56, the Wright engines in general, I think are much more highly stressed and much more of a concern than the Pratts. What people have told me is that if you get past about 50 hours with this engine, you're in pretty good shape. That it's, you know, it's liable to last you a long time as long as you take care of it. And I've got about 290 hours on it now. And I suspect I'll be able to get 800 or 1,000 hours out of it if I take good care of it. And I've got a scavenge system on it and a pre-oiler, and I try and fly it about once a week. I think that's more important than anything. And so I'm hoping for a good long time.
This same engine was, as somebody pointed out, was used in a lot of different airplanes, and it has different power ratings. Initially, it was at 800 horsepower, I believe.
Something like
when it first started, and the final ones were 1,525 horsepower. So
right.
It has a lot in the bag.
Yes, sir.
Have you had any contact with World War II pilots who have flown this, and specifically Rear Admiral Whitey Feitner, who was credited with 9 kills in the F-4F? And then a bunch more on Guadalcanal he didn't get credit for because he was battling with the Marines.
Yeah.
He's living in Washington, D.C. now. He's a Dedalian, a good friend of mine.
I haven't had the privilege of meeting any of the guys that flew it operationally, especially in the early part of the war. I've read all their... If they wrote a biography, I read it. I'd love to meet him. Sir, Daryl, where's your brother Daryl?
Uh-huh. Mike, when you decided to acquire a Warbird, why the Wildcat versus some other type?
Well, I've always kind of leaned towards the Navy, for one thing. There's no way I could do a Mustang or something like that, either financially or time commitment. I needed a relatively simple airplane. I wanted one that was really fun to fly, which this turned out to be. And there's no airplane with more history. So those were primary reasons.